Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
This show originally aired in November of 2019.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for mid-November. This week, we are very pleased to have as our guest Dr. Kirk Johnson, SANT Director of the Smithsonian Institute's National Museum of Natural History, here to speak with us about his recent book with artist Ray Troll, Cruisin' the Fossil Coastline. He is still in transit from Washington, D.C. to our fair city, but he was able to join us by phone. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A big hint for this sound is that it is one that you will only hear in the fall. We'll play it again and tell you what it is later in the program. And now to our phone interview with Dr. Kirk Johnson. Hey, Kirk. We are so happy that you were able to take time out of your busy schedule to join us. We caught you just off the plane in Seattle, right?
Yeah, no, I'm enjoying my hometown. It's a beautiful day in Seattle.
You're coming over this way to give a talk at the Marine Science Center. You and Ray Troll are joining us to talk about your new book, Cruisin' the Fossil Coastline. And I have to tell you that I am so enjoying the book. I got my own copy when it came out last year, but I haven't had much time to spend with it. And in doing this interview, I've had a chance to look at it, and I've just been loving it. I've been learning a lot and laughing, and it's just been great.
Well, the whole idea of the book is to let the readers have as much fun as Ray and I had when we were doing the road trip.
It really comes through. I mean, there's a lot of great information, but it's put together in such a user-friendly way that it's just a joy. So thanks so much.
And my pleasure. Really helps to have a fabulous artist at your fingertips, I gotta say.
Yes, indeed. How did you first get the idea for such a book?
Way back in 1993, I went to an exhibit at the Burke Museum in Seattle, and much to my amazement, there was an exhibit by Ray Troll and Brad Mattson about fossils. And I'd always thought of Ray as a fish guy. He's the famous Alaskan fish t-shirt guy. And when he strayed into my terrain, which was fossils, I was like, this is crazy because I loved his t-shirts. I thought, huh. And it took me a couple of years to figure it out. I was like, I need to just go meet Ray and I need to see if he'll work with me because I love what he does and I could add a lot of value to his world and I bet you he could add value to my world. And so I kind of went on a blind date to Ketchikan. I was up there fishing and I called him and pretended like, oh, it just happened to be in town. But it was great because I'm a scientist who collects artists and Ray is an artist who collects scientists. So it was kind of predestined, I think. And we've been working together now. Our first collaboration, I think, was 1998. So we're on like 21 years of doing projects together.
Well, it's magic for the rest of us. And that first book was Cruisin' the Fossil Freeway, right?
Yeah, that was a fun book.
I've got a copy of that one too. So I'm a fan, and there are a lot of people in Port Townsend that are big fans of both of yours. So it should be fun to have you here. So maybe we should start with a general overview of our Pacific coastline and what makes it so special.
You know, the thing about the West Coast, I mean, it's such a fabled and storied place, but there are a few people that have actually been up and down the length of the entire coast. And for our purposes, we started at Cabo San Lucas and the tip of Baja Peninsula and went all the way up to Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. So there's a whole big chunk of the coast in Alaska and British Columbia. And even in Washington, California, for that matter, where you can't get to the coast unless you go by boat or plane or some other means, because there aren't roads along the coast. There's lots and lots of rocks and tons of fossils and tons of hard places to get to. But I'm from Seattle and Ray's lived in Alaska for a long time, and we both had so many interesting stories about the West Coast. Like, let's just do the whole West Coast. And then once you have the idea, then stories start presenting themselves to you. And one of them was how long has the West Coast been a coast? Because in geology, nothing ever stays the same for very long. I mean, the Atlantic Ocean, for instance, is not that old. It's only 200 million years old, whereas the Pacific Ocean is much, much older. So the West Coast has been the West Coast for a really long time, probably close to a billion years, which is
wow,
kind of a remarkable thing. And, of course, it's always changing, but it has been the West Coast of North America for a very long time.
So when we think of something that old, we usually think of it as being really stable. But in the case of our coastline, it's still really dynamic, right? Why is that?
If you look at a globe, the Pacific Ocean is almost half of the globe. And it's ringed by what's called the Ring of Fire, these areas where the seafloor is plunging underneath the kind of edge of the continents and making volcanoes and earthquakes and stuff like that. So, and there are spreading centers in various places in the middle of the ocean. So basically, Pacific Ocean is making its seafloor and then burning its seafloor at the margins of the surrounding continents. And the result is all these fiery volcanoes. So it's kind of like your skin. It's always redoing itself. None of the seafloor in the Pacific is any older than about 200 million years old, but it's been an ocean for almost a billion years. So it's a place that keeps recycling itself.
Huh. It's cool to think of it in that way. And I learned in your book that the big fault zone in Seattle was only recognized as recently as 1992, which seems incredible.
Yeah, I know, isn't it? We used to grow up in Seattle, like, oh, those people in California, they're such idiots. It's always going to be earthquakes down there because of the San Andreas Fault. But it turns out that the mother of the fault is up here in the Pacific Northwest. And it's just that a really big one hasn't happened since the year 1700. There was a massive earthquake, probably a magnitude 9 earthquake that happened in the year 1700 that's recorded in Native American oral history, and it's also recorded in Japan, where they keep close records of tsunamis and earthquakes. And in Japan, in January of 1700, there was a big tsunami that came ashore that no associated earthquake. And that was a Seattle or West Coast earthquake that sent a wave across and flooded a bunch of Japan. And those things happen every several hundred years, and it's been several hundred years since they have a big one. So Seattle's quite nervous about a big earthquake here, as well they should be.
Yeah, well, yeah, all of us in this area, Port Townsend,
yeah,
too.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, like, well, none of us thought about it until the geologists figured it out. And it was a really incredible bit of sleuthing to figure out what actually happened. And, you know, it's like so many geology stories, they're very obscure and technical and complicated, but they're so beautiful and magical if you can simplify them enough that people have a chance to wrap their brains around what's going on.
It's been great to learn more in this book. So you grew up in the Seattle area, and all of this new information was just fuel to the fire of a subject that you were already fascinated with, right?
Yeah, definitely. I left here when I was 17 to go to college and never came back, and I became a geologist. So I'd come back to Seattle with new tools and new knowledge, and I'd see things that were really familiar to me, that they had totally changed in their relevance. And that's the same flying into Seattle today. I saw stuff like, oh, now I understand that. And when you're a geologist, you're always looking at every little aspect of the landscape, the shape of the hills, the height of the hills, the nature of the rivers. Everything tells a story. And the smartest geologists are the ones that have seen the most rocks. So we travel the world, you come back to Seattle, and you realize what a special place the Salish Sea is. I mean, the geology of this place is just remarkable, and it's still being discovered. I mean, it's still being studied and figured out.
Well, just like you were describing in the book, a lot of those places are not accessible by road, so it's really dependent on people coming in on it from a different angle, you know, coming in from the sea and being able to explore that way.
That's right, or using remote sensing or satellites or all sorts of different things you can use these days to look at the world. One of the most amazing things is LIDAR, which is basically a plane flown images which can see through trees, and you can actually measure the shape of the land. And if you look at Puget Sound on a LIDAR image, it is remarkable. It's this huge field of north-south trending hills called drumlins that are the unmistakable footprint of a giant ice sheet. And you never know that when you're driving around Seattle, that it is the bottom of an ancient glacial floor, and you can see it clear as a bell with LIDAR.
That's a really exciting tool that we've got at our disposal now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is one of many. There's so many cool new things that are out there. And science is like that. You know, every week, dozens of new discoveries are made. And if you're a scientist, every day is like Christmas because new stuff is just pouring in all the time.
Oh, it's a wonderful thing. So before we veer off on too much of a tangent, would you mind giving us a little bit of a geology primer? Like, how are mountains formed, and how does this then allow us to view fossils that were once part of the ocean floor?
Well, you know, on the West Coast, it's pretty straightforward. You get mountains in sort of two major ways. One is when a continent or a little piece of a continent collides with another continent. So it's just basically a slow motion collision. It's like two cars hitting each other, except they're going really slowly. I mean, a continental collision might happen at a rate of about 1 inch a year, but over millions of years, you can have a collision that'll make a giant mountain range. And that's things like the Coast Ranges of British Columbia or mountains like that. And then you can also have volcanoes, which just show up one day. I mean, that's the amazing thing about volcanoes is they weren't there and then they appear and you get them building up over time and then they explode and they go away. So something like Mount Rainier, which is a phenomenal mountain, it's 14,000 feet tall. That mountain's only been around for the last 500,000 years. There was no Mount Rainier 500,000 years ago. And I always like to put things in human time scales, and Mount Rainier is just slightly older than our human species. So if you think about something like that, looks so big and so vast, it's been on planet Earth about as long as humans have been.
Wow. I also love the pancake analogy that you describe in your book to help illustrate how we read the geologic record. Would you please sketch that out for us?
Sure. It's rocks are confusing. You know, if you haven't studied geology, rocks look like rocks, and they don't tell any messages. But often you see rocks in these layers, these flat layers. And what you're seeing in a flat layer of rock is the cross-section of an ancient flat landscape. So if you think about when you make a pancake, you put batter on the griddle and the heat makes the pancake. So the pancake has got a thickness and it's got width dimensions. And it's flat because the griddle is flat. So when you say flat rock layers, it means that those rock layers were formed on a landscape that was flat. And the kinds of places where you get flat landscapes are places like Louisiana, where the land is sinking slowly. Huge broad plains, a little bit of sand comes out, a little layer, it sinks some more, another layer, it sinks some more, another layer, it sinks some more. So those areas which are sinking are areas that form flat layers. The areas that are rising form mountain ranges and erosion. So I like to say the world has two kinds of places. There's places where the landscape is sinking and forming flat layers, and places where the landscape is rising and making mountains and eroding away those layers. So the way to find a fossil is find a place that used to be sinking and is now rising. You'll find those layers exposed for your viewing pleasure, and that's where paleontologists go. They go to places where they can see the layers that were formed by a sinking landscape and exposed by a rising landscape, and then that's half the game right there.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, that's a great explanation. And I also want to be sure that we review the importance of glaciation in our part of the world. It's really hard to wrap our heads around the fact that Seattle was once under 3,000 feet of ice. And that was relatively recently, right?
Yeah, no, it was here as recently as like 17,000 years ago, which is just not that long. I mean, human civilization's been around about 10,000 years. So, and there were people here when Seattle was covered by ice. I mean, we now have evidence of people from a site in Idaho that was just published months ago, where people were living in Idaho 17,000 years ago while there was 3,000 miles of ice on top of what is now Seattle.
Wow.
So it's you know, the ice isn't like a pre-human thing. There's probably some little shreds of inkling of oral history that go back to the time when Seattle was a massive ice sheet.
Oh, that's a cool thing to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I love these. Anytime I can put a human experience into a geologic time frame, it really helps to explain these big, vast, old things, these landscapes.
But some areas on the Olympic Peninsula escaped being covered with ice, right? There's a really cool map that Ray drew in your book about how part of Port Townsend was under the ice, but there are some places on the Olympic Peninsula to the south west that didn't get covered?
Yeah, basically the landscape that was taller than the ice stood up above the ice. So, and that is in fact how we know how thick the ice was, is the early geologists here around the turn of the century, around 1903, 1910, were able to walk along the edge of the mountain ranges and see the line at which the ice did not get any higher. Because the ice sort of abraded the sides of the mountains. And so all around the west side of the Cascades and the east side of the Olympics, there's sort of like this scrape line. And all he did was map the scrape line. He's like, yep, that was an ice sheet that got to this high. And, of course, the Cascades go up 5,000 or 6,000 feet. The Olympics go up to 8,000 feet. So there are big chunks of those mountain ranges that stood above the ice. And as a result, the ice kind of formed this big lobe that projected down into the South Puget Sound area. And all of Puget Sound is all the fjords and all the channels, everything in the islands of Puget Sound are all the remnants and the result of being underneath a huge ice sheet. Anytime you travel in the Sound or take Washington State Ferry, you're just cruising around on what used to be underneath the ice sheet.
You know, it is so hard to think that way. I mean, you just have to keep reciting it to yourself and looking at maps and looking at the surrounding landscape and imagining what that is like.
And, you know, most people don't have any experience with giant ice sheets. I mean, I just spent the better part of last summer doing a NOVA special about the Arctic and the Antarctic, which is going to air on PBS on February 5th, which is a two-hour special about polar regions.
Oh, cool.
And I got to spend a lot of time on top of ice sheets. I was up on the Greenland ice cap, and I was down in Antarctica. And that's like being on a different planet. So people shouldn't worry if they can't imagine it, but what they should do is buy a plane ticket to Greenland and go look at an ice sheet and realize that even today there are these huge sheets of ice that lie on top of continents. I mean, the Greenland ice sheet is 10,000 feet thick.
Oh my God, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's 2 miles thick.
Wow.
And it covers the entirety of Greenland, which is something like 600 or 700 miles by 200 or 300 miles. I mean, it is a massive sheet of ice, and you can bet that the surface of the land in Greenland that's 10,000 feet beneath the ice is being shaped and marred by the ice. And when the Greenland melts, you'll get a landscape that kind of looks like Puget Sound.
You know, Kirk, as we knew would happen, we've run out of time today and we've barely grazed the surface of what we'd like to know. But you lucky listeners will be able to you'll be able to hear the second part of the show next month. Way better would be to go to hear Kirk and Ray Troll talk about their work and adventures in person this Saturday, November 16th. Thanks so much for joining us, Kirk. We'll look forward to hearing you and Ray speak on Saturday.
It's always a pleasure to talk about rocks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. And there are some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about this week.
The Olympic Peninsula chapter of the Audubon Society is very busy this month. First, on Thursday, November 14th, join them for a field trip to Gardner and Diamond Point from 8:30 to noon. Then, on Tuesday, November 19th, you can spend most of the day with them. In the morning, there is the beginning birds class at the Dungeness River Audubon Center from 10 a.m. to 1, followed by a discussion of the book, The Wonders of Birds, from 4 to 5:30. The following evening, Wednesday, November 20th, gather for their monthly meeting on the birds and wildlife of Patagonia from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more details.
The Port Townsend chapter of the Audubon Society, Admiralty Audubon, also has a field trip. This one is to Kaitai Lagoon and beyond on Saturday, November 16th. Meet at the Port Townsend Park and Ride at 8:30 a.m. or go to admiraltyaudubon.org for more information.
Lastly, of course, please come hear lots more about the wonders of our fossil coastline. Our guest Kirk Johnson will be on hand with artist Ray Troll to speak about their recent book, Cruisin' the Fossil Coastline, this Saturday, November 16th, in a special event co-sponsored by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, Centrum, and the Port Townsend Center for the Arts. Come to the Commons at Fort Worden. The program starts at 7, but doors open at 6 p.m., and we recommend that you get there early. Please go to ptmsc.org for more information.
And here's our mystery sound again. You will probably have a much easier time identifying the sound if we play the whole track for you. Here goes. The first sound that we played for you is the sound of elk antlers rattling against each other as the bulls spar with each other, which is often accompanied by bugling calls from other males in the area. It is not only breeding season for deer, but it is breeding season for our Roosevelt elk as well, and this is a great time of the year to go see and hear them. Here on the east side of the peninsula, there is a small herd that lives around Squim, and another that concentrates their activity around the Dosey Wallops and Duckabush River valleys. They are much more commonly seen over on the west side of the peninsula. It was our friend Fred Sharp's idea to use the antler clacking as a mystery sound for Nature Now, and he sent us a great video clip of elk sparring with each other in a meadow on the outskirts of Squim a couple of weeks ago. It is amazing to see these big bulls push each other around with their giant racks, and the sound of the antlers crashing against each other can carry a long way off. Apparently, the sound attracts other males to the vicinity to weigh in on the competition in the same way that the beautiful, eerie bugling call does. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the week of November 11th. Thanks very much to our guest, Kirk Johnson, for taking time out of his crazy schedule to visit with us. Thanks also to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Closing music is Fossil Rock Anthem, a parody of Party Rock Anthem by LMFAO, and it's put together by Science with Tom. As always, happy trails.
Fossil rock. Yeah. Woo. You dig?
Fossil rocks are in the ground tonight. They've been down there for a really long time.
Yeah.
They contain the history of life.
Woo!
They've been down there for a really long time.
Clap, clap.
Fossil rocks are in the ground tonight.
Oh.
They've been down there for a really long time.
Play the schist.
They are literally on the grind.
Yes.
Take your hammer out and
break that.
Rock, plus plants and animals stuck in the spot, huh? Each new layer stacking up, so the oldest on the bottom and the newest on top. So how old is your fossil, bro? Well, it was pretty far down, so it's pretty darn old, and I dated this one, so I got to know. It's from 3.5 billion years ago. Yo, I got that lava flow, volcano air full of particles and smoke. There goes life as they know, now that's a blast. Most rocks ain't moving that fast. The sediment's evidence like a present, telling us of the past.